to the Bites and Bites podcast, your go-to source for insightful conversations between the realms of cybersecurity and the food industry. I'm your host, Kristen Demaranville, and I'm thrilled to guide you through today's exploration of system thinking within our food safety and security frameworks. In today's episode, we are joined by Carl CJ Yunus. He goes by CJ, whose expertise in system engineering brings a vital perspective on the indispensable role of system thinking in fortifying our food supply chains. CJ's approach illustrates the nuanced challenges and strategies essential for defending against cyber threats in the food industry. Additionally, as we unfold today's dialogue, it is critical to note that our conversation was recorded in January of 2024. It's a fascinating discussion that touches upon potential vulnerabilities and cyber attack scenarios within our critical infrastructure, reminiscent of recent events that have since captured our industry's attention. While today's episode precedes those developments, CJ's insights are more relative than ever, offering a profound understanding of the proactive measures and systematic resilience necessary in our ongoing battle against cybersecurity threats. Let's leap into a world where system thinking isn't just a method, but a requirement for our collective safety and well-being. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. We've already been laughing. So if you're hearing smiles, that's happening in real time for us. I have a great guest here today. I'm going to start off with the great questions of favorite food and favorite food memory first. CJ, take it away.
So let's see, Kristen. Favorite food memory is thin crust pizza in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The Italian community there is absolutely incredible. And their thin crust pizza at some of the restaurants is even better. So we have... You know, Chicago talks about their deep dish. I mean, we can talk about deep dish, but when it comes to thin crust, I mean, that's a thing. Good stuff.
Yeah, I'm an East Coast dweller, and I know that all my East Coast fans, even the ones that are living in other parts of the country, are going to have it out with me later. But I still really like, you know, Midwest pizza. Sorry, like I really do. It's the square thing for me. I don't know why. And those little burnt crisps that we were talking about right before the show started recording, those little bits at the beginning are like an pizza appetizer. Like, they're so delicious. And you could have a plain cheese pizza and it's amazing. It doesn't have to have all the toppings on it, as far as I'm concerned with the Midwest.
This is true. And then, you know, you throw some mozzarella sticks in with that little equation and, you know.
Oh, always, right? Yeah. I mean, if you're going to just be gluttonous, go all the way in.
Oh, yeah, we're all in. Absolutely.
So that's your favorite food. And so what's connected to that, your favorite food memory? Is it eating it in Milwaukee or is it different something else?
Eating it in Milwaukee. Yeah, absolutely. Growing up there as a kid, you know, the Friday nights or the Saturday nights with the family, just going to the local mom and pop pizzeria. Yeah, there was a place near Mequon, Wisconsin called Millie's. Really good mm-hmm. crust pizza, you know, get the Parmesan on it with some pepperoni, game on, and some mozzarella sticks. Or the breadsticks. I mean, we were kids at the time, so we were like human vacuum cleaners. So it's, you know, game on. So
yeah, that's true. It's totally true. I did live in the Midwest for a little while, and I still dwell on the food because it's such a food area, really is between the production. A lot of those cities in the area are foodie cities, in my opinion.
Kind of got that cheese thing going on, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're lactose intolerant, sorry. You may not want to go to Wisconsin.
Safe to be when it comes to being a lactose intolerant individual.
And also, there's a lot of really great beer there. One of my best friends lives in Wisconsin, and he's always raving about the craft beer scene. Shout out to Joe. I know you're listening. Yeah, he's always telling me I got to go just for the beer.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you're not wrong there. The craft beer scene has gone pretty nuts. Spotted Cow is always a good one. I cannot drink Spotted Cow, unfortunately. I mean, I could digress into that. Certain hops that my body is not a fan of.
Yeah, I feel that. I'm not an over hoppy kind of person. I don't really prefer that kind of thing. Like a Hefeweizen or something like that is too much for me. Tastes like soap. Honestly, that's how my palate reads it. And I'm sure it's just because I'm not refined enough in my beer tasting, but I could definitely throw it to the table for wine. So if you want to throw it out on like palate for that, I got you.
Wisconsin's got the whole alcohol
scene too in the winter time. So
that's true. Well, what else are you going to do in the winter? I mean, other than like ice skate,
hockey, ice skating, curling, like all ice fishing,
you know, all the Midwestern-y stuff.
One of the things that shocked me is I grew up in New England, so I'm surprised I'm shocked by this, but I really appreciated the ingenuity and the innovation of the Midwest. There'd be any type of water runoff from sewage, little like you know, those little ponds that sit next to developments, things like that, those would always be hockey rinks. They turn them into hockey rinks every year. And I just was like, what is this? But then I realized, like, how brilliant is that? So you don't have to pay to go to a hockey rink, and you're just making it, and it's fairly safe because the, you know, it's not super thick ice, but it's not super thin ice. It's perfect, you know?
Absolutely. So yeah,
there's definitely a lot of creativeness when it comes to hockey rinks and ice skating and just any winter sport for that matter. So it's pretty rock solid. So
yeah, I saw my first hockey game, I think actually in the Midwest, like in a proper stadium. Yeah, I mean, it was Minnesota, so sorry to anybody, but, you know, it was fine. I really...
Long time, so it was a lot of fun.
And now my son plays ice hockey, and we're actually headed up to a tournament this weekend.
Hockey is so crazy, and I commend you for being a hockey parent, because that's a commitment in itself. I had friends who were hockey cheerleaders, which was very strange to me to think about to this day, but they cheered in the stands, sort of like basketball, and that's a thing. I didn't know that was a thing.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, this sport is not for the faint at heart. It is rather violent. And, you know, if you want to pick a fight on the ice, you can do it. But then you're going to go take a rest for 2 minutes or 10, depending on how bad you beat the other person up.
I think it's the adrenaline come down, like the 2 minute like timeout. Like, OK, you got it out of your system. Just go. Here's your juice box. Sit in the corner. You're fine. And then we'll put you back in, and then you can ramp up again. You know what I mean? It's like toddlers on skates is what I always think. And sometimes it's like, it's have a fit, get a goal, and then we just have a break, and then we move on.
We can probably beat the living
snot out of you.
Yes. So just really big toddlers.
Really big, I mean, angry toddlers.
That, you know, have some displaced aggression that they probably need to get rid of.
I never thought I'd talk about hockey on this podcast, but that's great. Anyway, CJ, will you introduce yourself to all of the listeners?
Okay. Well, hi, listeners. My name is CJ Yunus. I have a very interesting background and career, as we have discussed. Former Special Operations, United States Marine Corps, former federal agent with the National Nuclear Security Administration. I was the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program Manager for the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security in the Office of Emergency Management. I spent 10 and a half years at Sandia National Laboratories as a systems engineer, doing some very interesting things for some very interesting clients in the United States government. And I am currently employed with the United States Space Force. So that's pretty much me in a nutshell.
And I know you usually have a disclaimer, CJ, when you do types of media. So go ahead and drop that.
The opinions are of mine and not of the United States government or the United States Space Force. So thank you for that reminder, Krista.
Those are a lot of, I'm sure there's crazy acronyms behind a lot of those. Actually, I smiled at one point when you were speaking because I thought, wow, that's a mouthful. There must be an acronym for that. It's the government. Absolutely. Of course there is.
Absolutely. They say, well, food, how do you get into food with all of that kind of background? Well, a lot of the stuff that we had to do was around food and critical infrastructure and ecosystems architecture and all of those other fun things. So we can dive into that conversation a little bit more.
Absolutely. And as soon as you said critical infrastructure, I smiled too, because I was like, yay, there's the connection. I know some of the listeners got it quickly as well. There is something really important, though, I want to ask about, because one of the first things that you spoke to me about when we met and you actually sent me was a white paper that you were co-authored on.
Yes.
So I just want you to give us a little brief bit about that, because I think a lot of people that are listening will be interested in it.
Sure. So that paper we talked about, one of the main reasons that I got introduced to you was food and cyber. And that's not something that's necessarily talked about nor broadly understood. And I think the difficult thing about food and cyber is it's great when it's working. It's not so great when it isn't. And I think the bigger problem here is many of the cyber systems that currently exist in the country are very vulnerable. And a lot of people don't necessarily make the association with cyber and food, because a lot of these electronic systems are ultimately responsible for running a lot of these ecosystems within these companies. And cyber posture that they have isn't the strongest in the world. And when a zero day comes in, or a Trojan horse comes into the system, it can literally wipe out accounting, distribution supply chains, day-to-day operations.
Secret recipes.
Name it. It will literally impact that entire ecosystem that is that company. And that can be a very big challenge to recover from that. So back up your data, folks. And, you know, external hard drives are a beautiful thing. That's all I got to say about that.
I remember the tape drive days, you know, when they'd show up in the armored car and then you'd have to hand over the tapes like you're some kind of like mafia secret agent or something. But it was one of the best ways to deal with it, because it was going off site. And that was a bakery company that was moving their tapes off site. It says a lot about how serious they took data security.
Well, and you know, it's interesting to have that conversation when we talk about the cloud, right? It's another computer ecosystem and another remote location that has vulnerabilities as well. And I don't think a lot of people really think of the cloud like that. But again, looking at your cloud architecture and your cloud infrastructure is absolutely critical and trying to disseminate how I go about doing some of these things, why they're important, who they ultimately impact, why should we be doing these things, and is it going to impact my bottom line? Well, again, it's not a problem until it is one.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of people live by that posture, and there needs to be some risk analysis and some categorization of risk and looking at how critical risk is to your organization and why those things are critical and who they ultimately impact. So
a lot of this comes down to people just aren't aware, or they think, oh, it's not going to happen to us. Example, there's a bunch of examples I can give, but one of my favorite ones is my folks just came to visit not too long ago. And I live just outside of Washington, D.C. We're driving around and my dad was like, what's that building? They all look the same. And I went, oh, it's a data center, Dad. That's the cloud. And I just kind of said it like off the cusp. And he was like, really? The cloud's there? And I was like, well, part of it. I said, Dad, that's part of the cloud. And I said, you can tell which ones probably are covering government because they have armed guards and extra security on the outside. And there's cameras everywhere. And he kind of looked at me funny. And I looked back at him like, this is the world we live in now. Is this where our data, this is how it is. This is your email. This is everything. It's right here, you know, not specifically at those data centers, but the concept was there. And he just kind of looked at me funny, like, wait a minute. So where was it before? I said, oh, it was on-prem. Like it was at your site of work. And a lot of the production factories and things like that, critical infrastructure, still a lot of it is on-prem and it's a lot of legacy. And a lot, I know everybody's just going to be like, oh, it's a dead horse you're beating, Kristen, with the legacy equipment. Well, it's still a fact, people. We're still using like Windows XP and younger in some of these places. I've seen Windows 95 second edition, which is a fairly stable operating system in itself, but you're never going to upgrade it and you're never going to touch it.
And there are some government systems that are still running Windows 98.
Yeah. And you don't touch the dust on them either, because that dust will throw it off as well.
No. Just stay away.
Just leave it alone. Leave it in its little box, like just as is.
I have seen some tech that is so old, like fiber optic stuff, that is literally as hard as a rock. And if you were to touch it, like, don't go near that thing. Don't touch it. You will break it. And we don't have any replacements, or we don't have any spares for this. So don't touch it.
Yeah. And that's some of the hard things about the food industry, too, is to upgrade some of this equipment, whether it's like a Zebra or a Zebra printer, depending where you are, or something to that effect, that of different software that's on these machines would cost millions. So you're going to want to keep it at whatever legacy level you have, because you don't want to have to, you know, shell it out. Problem is it becomes that vulnerability that is now an attack vector if you don't drop good security controls around it. And then you're going to be paying out more than you would have just to upgrade it in the first place, ultimately, depending on what cuts into your system.
And to your point, the level of risk analysis that you need to do around some of those things is really, really critical. So if you get into a battle rhythm in your company of looking at replacing your servers and your operating systems and your UIs on a fairly regular basis, it becomes a battle rhythm. But if you never really considered it because it's always in the background and always operating as a piece of your infrastructure, it's one of those things that you really need to consider moving forward, because here's the thing. Technology now is exponentially compound, not by the year, by the month. It's 2024 and things are moving really, really fast. So our ability to compute and put things on the cloud and the ability for servers to work even faster. And then we're starting to talk about potential quantum computing opportunities. And wow, I mean, I've seen some systems that are about the size of my coffee table that literally have 1,000 cores in them immersed in liquid. I mean, that is the next iteration of high performance computing and being able to understand some of these complexities and why they're important, who they impact, and so on and so forth. So these are not trivial things, and people need to start thinking about the complexities and the ecosystems and the ecosystems of ecosystems architecture, because everything is connected.
That's right.
Directly and indirectly.
It just made me think about how fast innovation happens. Probably the easiest way to give that visually for people who are more visual learners is think about the mobile market, the cell phone market, right? We came back with the bags with the, you know, you pick up the phone, it was the size of a shoe, you know, like to put your ear, and it had like a battery life of like 3 minutes or something ridiculous like that. And then it's now we have these like thin little things that fit in our pockets that are supercomputers practically, right? Yeah. That can have magnetizing on them that we can charge magnetically and all these other crazy things, Bluetooth, and, you know, you can record on it. It's got cameras that are better than actual cameras and things like that. If you think about that evolution, think about that on a different scale for innovation when it comes to the food industry, because they are there. And they've been there for a long time.
And I think to your point, Kristen, it's you know, somebody put in perspective for me. So the average smartphone has 190 million lines of code. It's pretty wild to consider the complexity of that statement all by itself, because quite frankly, that's a lot of code.
A lot of code. Moving back to your paper, CJ.
Yeah.
Can you define what is food systems or food system resilience within that? So, because people need to have that context and understanding to kind of really get what we're going about to talk about.
I mean, there's two things within food system resilience. There's food safety and then there's food security. So those are two important things, but resiliency in food. I mean, people talk about food safety and food resilience, but those two other things that we just discussed are really critical as well, but they all tie into each other. So I think it's really important that the food resilience piece is understanding the ecosystems and the infrastructure that support food distribution supply chains, day-to-day operations, communications, the infrastructure, your cloud computing infrastructure. So looking at resiliency in those systems is really critical as well. But not everybody looks at those things because those things operate seamlessly on a day-to-day basis. And that's something that most people don't think of, because when you go to the grocery store, you go and pick up your stuff. Well, how did that stuff get there? Well, there was a logistical distribution supply chain that was critical for getting that food from point A to point Z and all the interconnects and the last mile and so on and so forth. So that distribution supply chain is absolutely critical when it comes to reefers and 18-wheelers who move this stuff move this product all over the country. So again, those are really important things. So what happens if we have fuel disruptions in our economy? It's like, well, guess what? Or high gas prices. Well, that gets transferred down to the consumer. So again, all of these things are relative, but they're never really, they're like, why are my food prices so high? Well, inflation is one. Getting your product from point A to point B is another. So again, these things are always passed on to the customer because the manufacturer or the distributor isn't going to eat those costs. So it gets passed on to the consumer ultimately. So these are all conversations for consideration in food resiliency that need to be considered, because this ecosystem's architecture is absolutely critical, and understanding all the intricacies of it are absolutely critical. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're having this conversation.
Thank you for tuning into the Bites and Bytes podcast. We're going to take a quick break to remind you that we're always looking for guests who are shaking up things in cybersecurity and the food industry. If you or someone you know has a unique perspective on how cybersecurity impacts the food industry or the industries that support it, we'd love to hear from you. Check out the show notes for a link to our podcast website and the guest form. Now back to our conversation with CJ. Yeah, you're just making me thinking too about how prices have risen with certain foods. And I think a lot of people have a misunderstanding of what that is because they don't think about the whole supply chain aspect, but it goes beyond that. I know we've talked about this, CJ, but like environmental issues cause major systems disruptions. Think about the bee crisis. We have a real lack of bees. Bee colony collapse disorder is a big problem in this country. We need bees to pollinate fruit and almonds, avocados, the whole thing, right? And if we don't have those or have a small amount of them, the price is going to go up. So when people are complaining that their avocados were costing too much, think about it. Do you really need to buy that like SUV that's pumping out extra stuff into the environment? I mean, it really goes, it goes full circle, right? It goes full circle. I mean, are you dumping your trash inappropriately? Are you using water in inappropriate ways?
Highlight here is, you know, COVID kind of was our reset in thinking per se, because when everybody was staying home and nobody was using fuel, carbon emissions went down, like all of these other things. There's a lot of ebbs and flows that you can look through these process flows, and being able to visualize those things in a potential canvas or a visualization are absolutely critical because it involves process flow. Well, these distribution supply chains are process flow. It just happens in real time, and it's not things that we see because we always assume that it's going to be there until it isn't.
Correct. And I think I've had this conversation a lot. I'm going to continue bringing it up because I feel like until I feel satisfied that people are educated about it, then I will stop talking about this. But how our food is produced and how it gets to our plate is really important for consumers to know, because we vote with our money, right?
Absolutely.
And also, we can force companies to fix their digital strategies as well, because we should be concerned about cybersecurity with the food on our plate. What bothers me is still people think that the agricultural industry is so analog, and they're probably one of the most digitalized systems we have. And it's all over the place and crazy, and they're into big data, and they're into, you know, the cloud already, and they're into all these great little gadgets that are helping out. I just find it really funny that people assume that people are hand milking cows. And that just amuses me every time I think about that, because we'd have to hire thousands of people to do that just for a day. And then all that milk isn't from one cow that you get in your carton. It's from multiple cows. It goes in one big vat, essentially. And I really think we need to, if we're going to continue to understand the world that we live in, we have to understand this type of supply chain. We have to understand how it intersects with digital and how we can keep things safe. Because ultimately, I mean, CJ, you spent the majority of your career and your lifetime protecting in some capacity, right? Whether it's physically or digitally or policy or any of that in between space, it's a daunting task to re-educate people to understand that their behavior and what they do impacts the whole cycle, the whole circle.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not wrong. And I think the interesting thing about this is these ecosystems are everywhere. We live in a systems-based society. And a lot of people don't think of it like that. But your roadways, your sewer systems, your communication systems, your traffic lights, those are all powered by some type of SCADA system or computer. And again, they operate seamlessly, but what's the one thing that's really driving that narrative? Electricity. And what happens when we don't have electricity? I can't talk to you via a web link. We don't have the ability to communicate. If the cell towers go down, we have no cellular communication. Again, these are things that are not thought about because they operate on a fairly seamless basis most times. But when electricity goes out and we have a very vulnerable electrical grid, guess what happens? Bad things start happening and they start cascading out of control. And one of the things that I talk about in the paper that you mentioned is one of those lifeline infrastructures, electricity being one of those things that's really, really critical for our day-to-day operations. And when those things cease to exist, the cascading implications of that piece of infrastructure are astronomical, and most people can't grasp the level of complexity that's involved.
I think as people understand electricity to be like, you know, the equipment that we're talking on right now, or the lights, or something to that effect, but people forget that it controls water treatment facilities. But, you know, it controls so much. I mean, we've all seen the disaster movies. I try to avoid them because I feel like I could just hang out in real life for a minute. It's way worse, you know? However, those scenarios are actually very much along the lines of what people prepare for. And it scares me that we're so disassociated with it, because we just are so privileged that we have these things that we don't think about it. Too busy worrying about whatever reality TV show or, you know, whatever new series to start thinking about what is my impact to that and how can I affect the system. And you and I have spoken about this too, CJ, that my first mindset of flipping on to system-based thinking, it was actually cycle thinking. I have a degree in environmental management. And when I started to realize that everything was a natural cycle that just repeated itself, it was the water cycle that really kicked it in for me. We don't have no new water. Glaciers are not new water. That's just old water that happens to be frozen. It eventually will hit the cycle. Exactly. So it goes up into the atmosphere, comes back down. It just keeps going. And the world is very much a cycle. You have cycles of everything, air, soil, you name it. There's something to do with the cycle. Even life, our life is a cycle.
It is. It absolutely is. And I think to your point, which makes this really interesting, because when you're talking about these cycles, you're talking about a lot of engineering, right? Because we have a lot of engineers. But as a human race, we replicate a lot of things that occur in nature. And a lot of people don't seem to make the assimilation there, because there's a lot of things that occur in nature. If you look at the veins in your body, it looks a lot like the limbs on a tree. It's just microscopically smaller. So again, these are all things. And we look at some of those networks, and we look at some of those ebbs and flows, and we look at river systems, and they look like gigantic veins that spread out through a state. And once you start doing infrared and you look at these things and you're like, holy cow, this is a very complicated and complex network and an ecosystem. So again, when you start taking things out of nature or putting them back into nature, the ecosystem is going to change. And the same thing could be said in industry, in the private sector, in government. And once you start understanding how all these things work, the world that you operate in becomes significantly clearer.
Yeah. And the food industry is such an example of that. You grow something, depending on how you grew it. Was it GMO, genetically modified? Was it not? Is it a new strain of hybrid type plant? Where it happens to that plant while it's growing? What kind of, what's going on with the soil? What's going on with the sunlight? What's going on with the weather? All that factors in. Insects, if you spray, if you don't spray, that kind of thing. And then when it hits the production facility, it changes again, right? And then it goes out something new that can be ingested,
yep,
whether by a human or a pet or anything in between, medicine, things like that. This is where I think as professionals, you and I, CJ, and we both echo this very clearly. I take this personally, you know, because we're ingesting food. This is life. This is life sustaining life, as I've been saying.
Sure.
And to understand that cycle aspect completely changes how you look at risk, completely changes how you look at risk, because everything is interconnected. You're almost humanizing it to a degree, and maybe not at the same time, because you are seeing that whole cycle. So if someone over in marketing does something on a system, it will affect production on some level, probably,
though.
But maybe. So vice versa.
And to your point, that's a lot of the reasons why marketing and engineering disagree on a lot of things, because marketing's like, oh, I can do that. And engineering's like, no, you can't. That's completely impossible. So they end up butting heads like this. And it's just, that's been going on for a very long time. Because nobody is considering each other domain space. And I think that's really, really critical. You know, walk a mile in my shoes and understand where we have to go with this. Because if you're making promises that engineering can't keep, the impacts of a statement and the attempt at that execution becomes a very difficult thing. And a lot of people don't really understand the impacts that you're talking about.
And then like the disinformation and misinformation and the distrust of the brand. I mean, there's so many things going on. I mean, like we said, we have a lot of misconceptions of the food industry as a whole anyways, because of the marketing machine, because, right, you know, the dairy industry, as an example, to take it back to the Midwest, likes to portray happy cows that live, you know, in a beautiful barn and have sunshine and, you know, grass. And that's not necessarily the case in all farms. I mean, there's some farms that do. I think the fact that we are so blinded to that in some ways, or just don't want to know, just we go to the grocery store and buy our milk, it's fine, and we move on with our lives.
Yeah.
I think we're doing ourselves a disservice to how the system works. And we're not trying to be like doomsday people here. We're not trying to be conspiratorial or anything like that. We're just trying to present a new system of thinking.
Right.
And I feel like a lot of times I'm the crazy one in the room, because I'm like, well, that's interconnected over there. Why don't you see that? That's very clear to me. I mean, it's one of those things. And I know you have the same moment, CJ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Too many times. You can't see this for what it is. Like, yeah, this is a problem. But again,
yeah,
when you look at a problem like this, you don't necessarily open up the aperture and look at the entire spectrum of the problem. And that can be a bit of a challenge.
Anzen Sage proudly introduces Anzen OT, our innovative AI-powered software as a service designed to simplify operational technology risk management. Anzen OT streamlines how organizations assess and manage cybersecurity risks in their OT environments by leveraging AI insights. Anzen OT empowers businesses to conduct comprehensive risk assessments efficiently and ensuring compliance and security without costly third-party evaluations. Ready to transform your OT risk management approach? For more details and to join our beta waitlist, visit anzenot.com. That's ANZENOT.com. Anzen OT, simplifying risk management where empathy meets innovation. How does does system thinking apply to managing cybersecurity risks, specifically in the food industry, in your opinion?
Yeah, looking at systems thinking in food is a really interesting thing because a lot of people don't necessarily consider how all of these things are connected or how operations or infrastructure or systems or human capital or cyber or integration architecture are really, really critical. And that all of those things that I just mentioned are an ecosystem that feeds off of each other. But looking at those things and singularly is important, but also looking at them as an ecosystem are really critical too. So looking at how all of those things behave and how one little hiccup in the system causes a multitude of potential cascading implications, the ways in which most people don't really understand, are really critical. And looking at that entire ecosystem piece and creating resiliency around those things and, you know, risk management in systems thinking is also really critical too, because those are things that aren't necessarily considered. If you're looking at one angle of the problem, well, there's several other angles of the problem that need to be considered with regard to cyber or human capital or distribution supply chains and so on and so forth. Electricity, just basic infrastructure to make an enterprise run. So these are things that are really important. But again, I can apply this business model to literally any industry. It doesn't have to be food. I mean, you know, there's shipping that's going to have issues. There's going to be communications that's going to have issues. There's going to be social media that you can obviously see a gigantic spider web. It's an interconnected spider web is what it is. And there are pieces and parts of it that have more influence than others do. But again, that perception becomes the reality for most people.
I mean, so well said. I think whenever I've done, I call them extended security assessments, which fit into the systems aspect, because you can't really say it's a security assessment unless you kind of put that little bit on there because you're thinking it differently. I've had conversations with everybody in the plant I could talk to, HR, marketing, engineering, IT, security, you name it. And they're all like, why are you talking to me? Well, you're working a factory. You're here. You're part of the whole. Like,
right.
you do on your side will affect the other side. So explain to me how you handle, you know, 5,000 temp workers that come in for the holidays. To me, that's affecting the whole bottom line, your production, your safety, your security. How are you managing the access for that? You know, that kind of thing. Are you deactivating their access when they leave? Who does that? You know, there's all these questions. And it's so interesting beyond that, you know, the supply chain aspect, which nobody's got figured out. It's all over the place. We're still working through what's priority and what's not. But I think with food, it makes more sense. You kind of know where the priority lies, keeping the food safe, right? That's we get that. So we can follow that supply chain a little bit differently.
Absolutely.
And I think to your point, there aren't too many industries that have direct reach back to over 100 million people in less than a week. I mean, that's,
yeah.
Everybody's got to eat at some point in the day. So again, there's just a ecosystem beyond comprehension that supports the ability to do that in restaurants, in large establishments, school lunches. Like, mm-hmm. There's just how many schools, you know, how many K-12 schools do we have in the United States, and how many people work every day to make sure that food is being supplied to those youngsters
on a daily basis.
And it's handled safely.
And it's absolutely handled safely.
So again, these are really important conversations that you don't get from a traditional education. You have to be a part of some of these industries up and coming to understand how the big picture fits into their particular domain space. And why are these things important, and who do they impact, and why do we need to be considering these things from a quantitative and qualitative
risk framework?
It's true. And this is why boards need to start making sure that they have not only cybersecurity on their boards, but also people who are these type of system thinkers, these bigger thinkers that can see in the whole aspect and be able to relate it quickly.
Right.
Even from environmental side, environmental sustainability, governance side, or ESG.
Right.
I think that it's super important to be able to have that type of person's of mindset there too, because that's just going to tie into cybersecurity. It's going to tie into IT. It's going to, you know, help your digital transformation. And I think that a lot of these firms that are out there, and I know you and I have talked about this, CJ, they're going through digital transformation so fast that they're not thinking about the compromises that they're making on the back end part of the cycle that we've been talking about.
Right. And I think to your point, what are the two major drivers for any enterprise organization? It's policy and governance. And most people don't necessarily consider that when they're executing on that policy and governance or trying to change something, the implications of a minor change in their policy and governance is going to have overarching and very widespread impact to the enterprise to which they are trying to set that policy and governance in. And that can be applied to literally any domain space.
It's true. I used to write policy, so I completely understand this. It's a lot of responsibility in writing it properly that will flow over every aspect of your business, countries, regions, different governments, things like that. It's really complicated. And then getting it right that fits into your corporate culture, and then being able to articulate that down to your employees so they understand why things are going, and then having them understand how it impacts them and they're part of the spoke of the wheel, if you will, to use a corporate term. And I worry a lot about the future, because I really feel like if we can't get it right now, I mean, we're just going to keep innovating super fast. So how are we going to, we're playing catch up. We're constantly playing catch up at this point. Within that, for the future trends, do you foresee more intersections between cybersecurity and food protection culture? Do you see how companies are going to start preparing themselves? Do you have any advice?
Yeah.
General thoughts?
So, yeah, all of the above. Those are going to be really important up and coming topics, and the way in which information is going to be disseminated, our communication systems, our logistics systems. I believe within the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to see exponential change in ways that we could have never dreamed about, with the insertion of particular technologies, with the insertion of distribution supply chains, the way in which electricity is delivered to us, or some type of fuel source that drives the way in which. So it's pretty wild. I think those things are really important, and I think it's critically important to consider all of these things and how they impact this ecosystem moving forward, because I see organizations switching to what they call visualization and canvassing and process throughput, because most of the people that we work with in organizations are very visual learners, and they learn. You can whiteboard it, you can look at certain things, but I believe that is going to be the next up and coming technology, and we are going to have a workforce that understands. So we have these silos that we operate in. I like to call them cylinders of excellence, because a lot of people don't necessarily understand I'm operating in this domain space. Well, that's great. Or I'm operating in this domain space, but we're going to need a whole industry of people that operate in those seams that are able to connect the dots as those outliers. So they are the connective tissue, like a ligament that brings those two things together so they can move and articulate accordingly. So we need a whole new workforce of folks that understand complexity and ecosystems and systems thinking to connect those dots in government, in the private sector, in industry, you name it. We're going to need those people moving forward. And there is no curriculum right now that really shows folks how to do that. And I'm working with some folks right now to help kind of characterize and bound some of those problems to create that clarity from complexity.
I've always been told I'm more of the disruptor. I could go between silos and run across. And CJ, you're very similar to me in that regard. Just got there through different avenues. And I've never been able to like pinpoint what was the exact moment where I felt like I could understand that. I guess I've always just been a connector and relator by natural personality. But how do you teach that other than I just see these connections? I don't know how to tell you how I see them, other than I can give you analogies that would work. Like, we've been speaking in analogies this entire time, because that's how we've started to communicate how we understand the world around us.
Right.
And I think a lot of it comes down to curiosity. I mean, CJ, you and I have talked about this too, that we're both insatiably curious. We're like, well, why are things like that? And why would you think that? And how come that's over there and not over there? I don't understand that.
And yeah, and to your point, it's an insatiable curiosity of, mm-hmm. of learning, unlearning, and relearning. And those are really, really important things for people who are curious about how things operate and why they're important and who they ultimately impact. Again, that's what drove me down the path that I went down. And again, I got this systems thinking mindset around it. And I finally was able to pinpoint it and connect with other people who have this insatiable curiosity like I do. I don't care what industry you're in. We all have the same problems. They just exist in different domain spaces. So again, these are not new problems. They're very complicated. They're very complex. And it's being able to work with people who have been through that same, I would say, potential hell that we've tried to articulate that message to folks. And sometimes it just doesn't get through. But again, when you start, I think society is waking up to some of the complexities that we're dealing with in politics and ecosystems, in a lot of different policy and governance. I mean, we're watching a lot of things unfold in the United States right now that are finally boiling to a point where we better do something about it. Otherwise, it is going to get out of control and it's going to take on a life of its own.
Yeah, and it will affect the global community very quickly as well. I mean, because as we stated, we're interconnected. So we need, you need us, we need you kind of thing. And I think that's another reason why I love working in the food industry too, is because it's a global supply chain. It's not just a national supply chain. I mean, it is, but it also goes beyond that. Because what we do to our soil and our water will affect the greater whole in the long run. How we transport goods to other parts of the world. You know, everybody talks about, they go to the fancy restaurants and they want to have certain things that are from different parts of the world and they're flown in that morning. Think about the amount of like fuel and logistics that go into making sure you have the steak that came from some part of the world that
sure.
You've never been to. And it's fascinating to me that we live in this world where you can almost instantly get that.
Right. And I think to your point, the way in which air travel is going to transform here in the next 10 years with regard to, you've got folks that are developing engineers and new airplane companies that are developing potential hypersonic ability. And getting from point A to point B is going to blow your mind. So Chicago to New Zealand or Chicago to Hong Kong, you're talking a couple hours as far as the ability and getting these things from point A to point B. So the rate at which we connect the world that much quicker is no longer science fiction. It is going to be science fact here very, very soon. And it is going to literally transform the way we do business
every level.
Yeah, I just wish we'd upgrade our rail system here in the States to get, a little bit more close to the rail system in Japan or something like that. Because imagine transporting goods at a higher speed and safely. I'm not picking on the rail industry. We all know that they've got their problems. Again, this is part of the cycle and the system that we're discussing, because the rail system has issues. We have issues moving product. We have issues with a lot of things. We have tampering for cybersecurity. There's a lot of questions there. We haven't even talked about OT or ICS. There's huge implications there. It's a lot. And I know, and I bear with everybody for listening to this, because I know that we're talking in a lot of like quote technical speak, because we are talking about terms that aren't necessarily part of your everyday. However, they are part of your everyday. You just don't know.
Absolutely.
And
to your point, I believe rail infrastructure is going to be coming into a renaissance as well. A lot of these designs, a lot of these things, even ocean shipping. I think the interesting thing is, you look at some of these manifests, they're all electronic. And what happens when those manifests disappear or you have a cyber attack? Like, there are anywhere between 20 and 40,000 shipping containers on the average. So again, if you have an electronic manifest, that data has to be protected. Data is the new gold, is the 21st century gold. So being able to protect that data and how critical it is to make sure that that data has some level of resiliency in it from a risk resiliency model is also critical too. So these all play into the equation.
We're just going to keep going more digital though. I mean, NFTs may not have, weren't the moment. They had their moment. They're not the moment now, but I really feel like that will eventually come back around in some capacity. I really do think we'll see things like deeds for houses being moved digitally instead of physically. I think we'll see things like car loans that kind of stuff will eventually be digital. We won't have to deal with it. I do think that eventually IDs, like licenses and things like that, will be digital. We won't have them. We won't carry things like that anymore. We're just going to carry one electronic thing, whether it's a phone or something like that. I don't know if we'll see it in our lifetime, CJ, but we'll definitely be seeing the creations of it in our lifetime.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think within the next 10 to 20 years, we are going to see technologies coming into the mainstream that we never potentially thought would.
Yeah. I mean, I get excited by it and also terrified by it at the same time. It's such a weird complex I have about it. Like, this is so cool. Oh God, how are we going to secure this? Or please don't let this come into a factory, or I don't want this touching anything to do with our critical infrastructure. Please do not attach an Alexa to the network. Like, don't do those things. You don't need an IoT tea kettle in your office. That's fine. You can have that at home. You don't need that in the office. They're too easy to be hacked anyways.
I would agree with you on all fronts. I mean, these are not easy things for folks to get their heads around, because everything in their day-to-day lives operates very, very seamlessly. Traffic lights, cell phones, electricity. We all overlook those things because they're operating seamlessly until they're not. And then chaos ensues.
And I think that just goes back to the unsung heroes, the people that are keeping us safe while we can just blissfully be ignorant about the things that go on. And this is one of the reasons why I love talking to the food professionals on the podcast, is because they're able to showcase what they do and let people know that they're doing everything they can to keep food safe and keep families together. And it is really one of those things that's just the same deal with cybersecurity. We're also unsung, you know, protecting and saving people, and we don't say a word about it. I think that you have to come into this in this industry or industries in a different way. And obviously, I have said this before, I come from a long line of firefighters. I think it just kind of goes without saying how I ended up here. I'm sure you have a similar story with that too, CJ, that you just kind of ended up into a position that you are affecting and helping to better people's lives because of your actions. But anyways, as we're wrapping up here, CJ, I would like you to just mention to people what you're kind of working on next, how they can find you if they want to continue these conversations. And also the really big question I want to ask is, how do people start to have system thinking? And I know that we said it's insatiable curiosity, which is, yes, I would agree to that. But like, what is kind of like the steps that they can start taking?
Sure.
So I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me at CJ Yunus. I've got a pretty solid following around systems and ecosystems. And there's a Systems Thinking Alliance that was created. And if you want to learn, there's some 101 classes that you can look at as how you get going around systems thinking. And they teach this. I'm coming out with some curriculum around international emergency and crisis management around systems thinking for some very interesting communities around the world. Yeah. So I think the biggest advice is if you're interested in this type of thing, there is a Systems Thinking Alliance. Take a look at my profile and some of the work that I've done and who I've associated with in the defense space. Those folks are really the up and comers for the systems thinking. There's a lot of very interesting organizations that are starting to get their head around some of these complexities. And I think that is really important. But again, if you are curious about your industry, go to the people who are responsible for operating your day-to-day operation. So one of the things that you and I were talking about earlier, vulnerability analysis. When I was doing vulnerability analysis for military bases, I would go find the guy with the biggest key ring. He literally had all of the keys and he had all of the institutional knowledge about that particular entity or place. And I said, if you wanted to shut this place down abruptly, what would you do? I'd go over and turn off that valve and turn off this switch and shut down this breaker and go from there. And it really gives you some very, very interesting insight as to how somebody in an operations domain would potentially attack your system. So again, if you're interested in being a bad guy, there's wargaming activities that take place for red on blue activities. I take great pride in scaring the hell out of people because it wakes them up. So it's a lot of fun, Kristen. So there are entire communities.
I mean, I'm part of cyber games a lot, I find them to be terrifying and also very entertaining, because just knowing that they could just do something in a snap of a fingers to get in. And it's funny that you say that you went for the biggest key ring. I always went for the oldest employee, like not chronological age, but like how long they've been with the company.
Biggest key ring. Like, I mean, that's a rock solid.
And they would tell you, because they're definitely the type that were like, get off my lawn. I don't want you here. So they would just tell you to make you go away.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time, CJ. I really appreciate it. And we'll probably definitely have you back on the podcast at some point, because there'll be more to come with this conversation, I'm quite sure, by the end of the year.
Yeah.
But anyways, I really do appreciate your time, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Kristen. Thanks a bunch.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of Bites of Bites podcast. A big thank you to our listeners for joining us today, and an enormous thank you to CJ for sharing his invaluable insight and expertise. Conversations like these help us stay informed, inspired, and ahead of the curve in the ever-intersecting world of food and cybersecurity. And remember, stay safe, stay curious, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.